and welcome to the Westminster Institute. I'm Robert Riley, its director. Today, we're especially pleased to have two guests to discuss the future of Ukraine. Our first guest is Herman Pershner, who is the founding president of the American Foreign Policy Council, a nonprofit public policy organization here in Washington, D.C. It began in 1982 with Herman as its president, a position he continues to hold to this day. Now, AFPC, for short, American Foreign Policy Council, has hosted Washington events for hundreds of foreign officials, conducted hundreds of briefings for members of Congress and former senior American officials. For more than a decade, AFPC has co-sponsored conferences focusing on Ukraine's political and economic evolution. Senior government officials of both Ukraine and the United States regularly participate in this conference series. Among his many publications, Herman Pershner published a very prescient monograph in 2004 titled Reviving Greater Russia, The Future of Russia's Borders with Belarus, Georgia, Kazakhstan, Moldova, and Ukraine. He also is the author of Post-Putin, Succession, Stability, and Russia's Future, which is also available in Ukrainian and Russian. Our second guest is Dr. Stephen Bryan, who's an expert in security strategy and technology. He has held senior positions in the Department of Defense, on Capitol Hill, and as the president of a large multinational defense and technology company. Currently, Dr. Bryan is a senior fellow at the American Center for Democracy within the Center for Security Policy. He has served as a senior staff director of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as the executive director of a grassroots political organization, as the head of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, as the deputy undersecretary of defense for trade security policy, and as the founder and first director of the Defense Technology Security Administration. He is the author of many, many articles and a number of books, including Technology Security and National Power, Winners and Losers, and of three volumes of Essays in Technology, Security, and Strategy. Dr. Bryan was twice awarded the Defense Department's highest civilian honor, the Distinguished Service Medal. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Why don't we start out with each of you presenting an overview of your perspective on what the future of Ukraine might hold. Herman, why don't you begin?
Okay, thanks, Bob. And first, I want to thank you for hosting. I think there's insufficient debate on Ukraine in Washington. And anytime you put together two people with slightly or maybe not slightly different points of view, I think public policy is served. I also want to add one thing to my brief introduction. I've been over 70 times to Russia and spent considerable time, especially in the 90s, trying to improve Russian-American relations during that period when it seemed far more possible than it does today. Today, when I think people are aware on the moral grounds of what is going on in Russia, the war crimes are in the tens of thousands, some of which are not debated almost by anybody credible. There have been many international organizations coming in. We see the nuclear blackmail that's being used by Russia. We see the deportation of 200,000 Russian children and teenagers to Russia, where they would be raised in the image of Putin's Russia, and other morally reprehensible things. But of course, the U.S. can't deal with every moral problem in the world, so it begs the question of what's U.S. interest in this. And if we permit Russia, through the strategic use of nuclear blackmail, through the use of barbarity and war crimes to cower a population, if we permit them to gain territory, it's just a matter of time before other countries and Russia again begin to do the same thing. I was just a few weeks ago in Vietnam and some months ago in South Korea. And there, what do you hear? You hear they want Russia to be defeated, because if Russia is seen to gain territory through nuclear blackmail, how long is it before the hawks in North Korea or Beijing think it worked for Russia, it can work here? The U.S. and the West can't stay the course if they're confronted with these threats. And the relevance of all this, and you say the same with Tehran and Iran, and by the way, also with Russia, because the history of Russian imperialism is to take territory, have a period of peace, and then to attack again. That's how this little Duchy of Moscow went to 11 time zones over a couple centuries. They fight, they rest, and they fight again. Think of how Poland was chopped up, 1771, 1793, 1795, another war in 1920, and then 18 years later as an ally of Nazi Germany, an invasion again. This bit of Russian imperialism is deeply in the psyche of the people that are running Russia today, and it's the reason why in Ukraine they say, we don't want to make a peace that's just a pause before the next war. It's why Finland and Sweden have wanted to join NATO, because Russian threats against their territorial integrity no longer can be taken with a grain of salt. They have to be taken seriously. It's why you have such ardent support from the Baltic states, from Poland, and from Moldova for a Ukrainian victory. They're afraid that if Russia begins to take ground, they'll be next on the menu for Russian imperialism. Now, what's the connection to the topic that you raised? The connection is simply that if Ukraine is going to gain back its territory, if Russia is going to seem to lose, that's only possible with Russian arms. If you listen to the four-star generals and three-star generals that have commanded in Europe, I'm thinking about Ben Hodges, Jack Kane, Phil Breedlove, Wes Clark, you know, they all say the fighting in Russia now or in Ukraine is stalemated because the West, meaning the U.S., because we're the only ones with capabilities, have not given enough weapons for Ukraine to launch a proper counteroffensive. They would say that no Western army would have launched an attack in the South over the last months without air cover. And without, and of course, we have not given Ukraine the air power in a timely fashion to do the job. So I think there is certainly an argument to be made that things are stalemated. There's an argument to be made, as some of these generals would make, that with proper weaponry, Ukraine still has a chance to get to the Azov Sea, to make Crimea indefensible, and to bring Russia to the negotiating table. But we won't know until that plays out. I think this is discussed, but what's not discussed, I think, is especially relevant, is the weakness of Russia. We focus on the weakness of Ukraine, and we try to think that Russia just can outlast Ukraine. I don't subscribe to that theory. I think there are deep problems in Russia, even though it's a bit opaque for us to see. You know, people look at an opinion poll and say, Putin's so popular. I mean, I can't imagine why anybody would quote an opinion poll from Russia. Can you imagine, Bob, if or Steve, if you got a call from a pollster you didn't know, what do you think of Putin? Of course you're going to say he's a great guy. There's no other answer. And even if you didn't, every polling organization in Russia has an intelligence minder that only releases what fits into the narrative. When I talk to people I've known for decades from Russia that still have connections in the elite, they tell me the elite have largely turned against the war. But are they doing anything? No, because they're scared. Nobody wants to stick their head up first. They've lost a lot of their money. They've lost a lot of their influence, but they don't want to lose it all. But is this a permanent condition? I don't think it's a permanent condition. There's a pressure building up in Russian society. There were 300,000 casualties coming into Russia. And Russian internal propaganda is very strong. but it's beginning to lose some effect. I see just today, Putin had a talk about the war as opposed to the special military operation, because everybody in Russia now understands it's a war. When your son does not come home because he's dead, and the neighbor's son comes home maimed, that builds up a building resentment and a pressure that may one day explode or not. There's no way to tell when you have what I think is a revolutionary condition in Russia. Think about Tunisia, where you had an Arab street vendor that set himself on fire under nobody's direction, and the whole Arab Spring exploded. I think some shock to the Russian system arguably could cause a change in governance. And of course, that's how dictators like Putin go out. We did a study at the American Foreign Policy Council of 120 post-World War II dictatorships of 10 million people or more, 42% out by coups, 20% by assassination. Putin obviously worries about that with his use of doubles, with the big table to separate him from anybody that might get poisoned to him. He's worried. He has reason to worry if the reports that I hear filtering out are true. And I think there are reasons for Russian patriots to be against the war. Just think about that. Before the war, was NATO bigger or was it smaller? Was it better funded or lesser funded? Was it more unified or less unified? Did Russia have dominance and or minimum heavy influence in the petroleum market in Europe? They won't get that back. What about the political influence that went with that? Will they get that back? They won't. And the Russian army has been weakened. So there's a lot of internal reasons beyond personal ambitions for there to be discontent that may lead to Russia pulling out of the war more abruptly than we can see. Do we know this? No. But to not consider it the way we consider a collapse from Ukraine, I think, is an unbalanced approach. And I think I've eaten up my 10 minutes, so I'll stop and let Steve go on.
Thank you, Herman. Steve, the floor is yours.
Okay. I don't want to eat up my 10 minutes, but necessarily. But I look at it from a rather different perspective. Mm-hmm. And I start with what's happening in the war. Where is it? And why is it? You know, what's going on? The plain fact is that Ukraine is losing the war, steadily losing the war. And there are a bunch of reasons for that. I mean, it's simple terms. They're a much smaller power than Russia. So you start there. That doesn't mean they necessarily lose, but it makes it tough because the Russians can throw in more manpower and more supplies at will. The Ukrainians cannot. Second thing to understand is that the entire offensive, which was organized by the United States and NATO, which included the British and Germans especially, and planned by them and provided the intelligence for the Ukrainians, totally failed. The whole idea of breaking through the Sourovikin defenses in the south, in the Zaporizhzhia area, and especially the Bradley Square area, didn't work out. In fact, it was worse than that. They lost a tremendous number of troops. The numbers are disputed, but it's a large number, which they couldn't afford. And they lost troops from some of their top brigades. So it wasn't just a loss of troops, but it was a loss of the best troops that they have in those conflicts. They also lost lots of Western equipment that was modern Western equipment. Take, for example, the Leopard tanks, which the Russians were able to kill in the fighting. So the Russians proved good at what the Russians call active defense, and the Ukrainians proved that it's very hard to break it. And in fact, they couldn't, and they took terrific beating for it. In other places, whether you want to talk about Bakhmut or you want to talk about Avdiivka or you want to talk about Lyman-Krasny area or any other areas, and the same story. The Russians have either managed to prevail slowly but surely, or at least they've held back the Ukrainians. So I think the Ukrainian situation is fairly dire. The argument that some of these generals make that it's a stalemate, I think, is wrong. It's not a stalemate. The stalemate means nothing's changing. The things are changing every day, and they're changing in favor of Russian advances in these different places. Avdiivka, which I mentioned, probably will fall in the next few weeks. And that's just one example. So I'm not very positive about these claims that if we only gave them the right weapon, we gave them immense amounts of equipment, billions and billions of dollars worth of hardware. We trained them. We provided all the operational intelligence, overhead intelligence especially, to help them be successful. And they failed. Now, there's a big argument between the Ukrainians and the U.S. that's going on kind of a sub rosa under the table, a little bit sur table. Basically, the argument is you didn't give us enough. That's what the Ukrainians say. And the U.S. says you didn't use it properly because instead of focusing in one place, you dissipated it in Bakhmut or other places when you should have stayed just focused on breaking the Suravikin defenses. You can argue that all day, but the reality is what happened and it's still happening. And of course, now we're going to put even more in, but we don't have much more to put in. I mean, people keep saying, well, we'll put more arms. What arms do we have that we're going to put in? And who's going to run them? We're going to put aircraft in. Who's going to fly them? The Ukrainian Air Force has been very badly depleted. They've lost lots of pilots and a few of them have defected. So what are you going to do there? Are you going to put American pilots in Ukrainian uniforms? That takes a big risk of expanding the war into a NATO war beyond the borders of Ukraine. That's what I would call you. It is a NATO war already, but expanding it beyond the borders of Ukraine creates a war all throughout Europe. Plus, the Europeans have very heavily depleted their war stocks, and we have too. The Germans are out of almost everything. The Poles are now very worried that they have enough left in their arsenal if they got into a conflict. And I think that's the pattern in NATO right now. So much has been shoved into Ukraine that there's very little left. The only place where we really have, in my opinion, some real superiority is air power. I think we're good on air power. I think we're very weak on air defenses. And that's a significant problem in this kind of war that we're seeing. We're also somewhat weak in UAVs. The Ukrainians are primarily using Chinese UAVs, the commercial ones that they put bombs on and use. So, you know, the nature of the war is kind of funny because you have on the one side, conventional artillery strikes, conventional war in even trenches. But on the other side, you have a whole new dimension of equipment, especially UAVs, which are becoming very, very lethal. We learned that even earlier in 2020 in the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, where the Azerbaijanis used Israeli and Turkish UAVs to decimate the Armenian defenses. And I know they're going to say they weren't Armenian, they were Nagorno-Karabakhian defenses, but I think that's an academic point. The real truth is that they were provided by Armenia and they were knocked out by the Azerbaijanis using this kind of equipment very effectively. The other things about the Russian army, I listened to Herman's argument that the Russian army was probably weak. I don't think it is. I think it was badly managed, no doubt about that, especially in the beginning, the first year of the war. Very bad tactics, especially in the first year of the war, and a lack of equipment in the first year of the war, and a lot of it was junk. I think that was also true. Well, that's changed now. We have to really face the reality that the Russians are compensating for those mistakes and errors and losses, and they're doing a much better job militarily than they did in the beginning, and have much better equipment than they had before. Meanwhile, our ability to replace lost equipment is very poor. We are trying to step up the production even of 155 millimeter shells. And it's very hard to do because these arsenals that we have are 100 plus years old. The technology is 75 years old or older. The throughput is very slow. And nobody wants to work in these sweatshops because they're miserable, horrible places to have to operate. So they can't recruit new workers, especially in the current domestic environment. The Germans are also trying to upgrade their manufacturing of 155 and other artillery rounds, 105s and so on. And they're doing it in Spain, where they have a new factory. But it's going to fall way short of the requirement. The Russians are shooting off at least twice, sometimes far more than twice, the amount of artillery at Ukrainian positions than the Ukrainians can answer with. So I think on the in terms of pure balance of forces, it's not good news for Ukraine. It's very bad news. And then, of course, then the question arises, okay, if that's true, and I think it is, what are we supposed to do about it? And there are two answers, both of which are not very pleasant. One answer is send in the troops, you know, make it an American war, send in the Marines, whatever. That's not an easy thing to do in this environment because we don't really have them to send in. And we don't have a way to jump off into that. We know air power, yes, we could do that. But we will have to face Russia's air defenses, which are quite substantial. The alternative, and Russian aircraft, which aren't bad, by the way. Su-35 is a decent, really a decent top-notch fighter. That's one option. NATO joins the war. And there are a few articles that are popping up here and there. Even one today I saw that says, well, NATO should now go to war. We should make Ukraine part of NATO immediately and go to war. That means a war in Europe. Are we ready for a war in Europe? Absolutely not. Are the Europeans ready for a war in Europe? I don't think they are. I don't think they want that. The alternative is some kind of negotiation, some kind of political settlement. Originally, there was supposed to be a political settlement in 2014, the Minsk agreements. That didn't work out. These agreements in 2014 and again in 2015 were not put into operation. They would have created autonomous regions, but still part of Ukraine, these areas that are now contested. And there are many reasons for the failure, but the biggest one, in my opinion, is the Ukrainians didn't want it, and they backed out of it. And no, they had a right to do that. They didn't have to agree to make these agreements, but they did, and then they changed their mind. Can we make a new agreement today? I don't know. Should we try? Well, right now, Washington's been opposed to it 100%. No. Zelensky's opposed to it 100%. No. NATO's opposed to it 100%. No, we don't want to talk to the Russians. We just want to put more sanctions on them and see if we can convince them to step away from the war. It hadn't worked. It will not work. And we're not going to win this war, in my opinion, with the military. We're going to have to win it politically and diplomatically. So I'll stop there and we can join into a discussion of that and other things.
I have a couple of responses. One of the reasons that Ukraine is leery of treaties is they signed a treaty in 1999, a binding treaty with Russia, far more teeth in it than the Budapest Accords, which is quoted, where Russia guaranteed the territorial integrity of Ukraine and agreed to settle any disputes by negotiation and peaceful methods. And Russia is, as Steve knows, has a history of breaking all kinds of treaties. They've not been very good about their adherence. So for the Ukrainians, it's a question of what they understand intentions to be, as, at least as much as what they can get on paper. I also think that the Russian military evaluation is correct on numbers, but not on equipment. Russia is now having to send World War II tanks in bad condition to the front because everything else has been destroyed. They're dependent upon Iran and North Korea to give them weapons because they can't make enough themselves internally. So I think there's a case to be made, as I said before, by General Hodges, General Keane, and others, that Ukraine has a chance. They don't say that they'll win, but they have a chance if we give them weapons in a timely fashion. You could say that before the Sorokin defense was put in the south, the Russians very good at defense in depth, had Ukraine had enough weapons to do the offensive, maybe they would have succeeded. And last point, stalemate, I think not. In the last few weeks, you have the Ukrainian forces have crossed the Dnipro River. They're now on the left bank. They've penetrated up to 5 miles. That doesn't sound like a lot, but they're now only 30 miles from the Black Sea and some of the supply lines going into Kherson Oblast, rather.
Yeah, can I come back on a few of those points, if I might? I don't have any brief for the Russians. You know that very well, Herm.
I know.
That's not my favorite place. But the fact of the matter is that the Minsk agreement was not just the Russians. It was the Ukrainians. It was the Council for Security Cooperation in Europe. It was the Normandy group, which were especially the Germans and the French, who were all guaranteeing this agreement. So it wasn't just a question of the Russians complying. By the way, it was also the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, or alleged republics, who signed it. It was agreed that they would sign. And more important than that is the agreement said that the Ukrainian parliament would set the terms of what would make them autonomous areas. They weren't going to be territorially part of Russia, which they are now, according to the Russians. But at that time, they were not. So there was a chance that these agreements, that the most important one was 2015. There were a lot of other provisions in those agreements. But the main one, in my view, was the autonomous areas. And autonomous areas exist all over the world in different places. So on the one side, that agreement is, of course, gone. The Zelensky said we were never serious. The former chancellor of Germany said we didn't mean it. It wasn't for real. We just wanted to lure the Russians along and that sort of thing. That's too bad, but you can't put that one at the door entirely of the Russians. In fact, hardly at all at the door of the Russians. We're failing. The failure was elsewhere. Now, when we get to the actual military situation, this is something which I follow very, very carefully. And Herman, I think you got to go back and take another look at your facts, because the truth of the matter is that the Ukrainians are not advancing. They're essentially starting to retreat in many areas. And the few places where they've tried to break the Russian stranglehold, especially down in the Krynky area across the Dnieper River, where they've been launching a big, desperate offensive right now, as we speak, is failing. So I just don't see how, in any scenario that I know of, military scenario that I know of, given the constraints that the other countries are not actually fighting, okay, not Poland, not Germany, not the US, not the British, no, not that they don't have people in Ukraine. They got tons of people in Ukraine helping the Ukrainian army, but they're not fighting. But if they bring in troops from NATO, that changes the situation. But as it now stands, it's not very good news for the Ukrainians. It's very bad news. It's not a stalemate. That's what they want you to believe in Washington. Well, it's a stalemate. We'll have to figure out, drag it out until we can produce enough equipment, and then the Russians will happily be destroyed. I don't see that scenario at all. I just don't see it. As you know, I don't see any way to justify that argument. It's a wishful thinking.
Based on satellite imagery, the Institute for the Study of War of the last few days has reported the advances of Ukraine on the left bank of the Dnieper.
That's the one I just mentioned, Krynky area. They have been sending boats across at night. Quite true. I follow ISW as well. But, and here's the but, the Russians are now destroying the boats. And what they did, which is kind of interesting, is they've introduced a new UAV. It's one they've had for a while called the Lancet, but they've changed it to have night vision, because when the Ukrainians are coming across is at night, and now they're destroying the boats that are trying to come across, and in the meantime they're blasting away at the small enclave that the Ukrainians have in the Krynky, basically in the Krynky area. They're not going to stay there very much longer. They can't. So I wouldn't be very optimistic about that. I mean, I listened to what our Secretary of Defense had to say, and we're going to get the Ukrainians, we're going to control the Black Sea, we're going to do all these things. Well, I don't see it. I just don't. I think it's just more, I think it's just soap suds, you know, it's not real. And I don't see how you can change the situation on the ground. And that's the thing you have to be aware of, is what's going on the ground. And you have to be honest about it. And what's going on the ground is not good news.
Gentlemen, can I ask you both to give your take on Vladimir Putin's address to the virtual meeting of the G20, in which he called the war a tragedy, and he used the word war. And we should think about how to stop this tragedy. He said, and quote again, By the way, Russia has never refused peace talks with Ukraine, unquote. Herman, is that just a propaganda ploy? Or?
Well, I think the Ukrainians' position is clear. If Russia wants to withdraw to its own borders, peace talks can begin. So he's aware of that. And would he put a serious offer on the table that he's willing to withdraw? Could negotiations begin? Probably, but I think if it was a serious offer, it would be done in private, not in public.
Well, if the Russians withdraw, that simply means the Ukrainians have won the war.
Yeah. That's right.
Which, as Steve says, doesn't seem to be happening. I call your attention to a recent statement by a retired Ukrainian lieutenant general who remarked that the frontline Ukrainian units are operating at 40% strength, or in some cases, 20% strength. And not from this lieutenant general, but from another source, was the report that the average age of the Ukrainian soldiers is now in the 40s.
Yeah, it's worse than that.
Well, I mean, the point is,
I mean, they have a terrible manpower shortage. I mean, the Russians are, policy is to bleed them. I mean, that's clear.
A couple of weeks ago, that's what the commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces said. This is turning into 1916 trench warfare.
Illusionary, yeah.
Which is what the Russians want, because they win a war of attrition. So obviously he was setting the stage for asking for more advanced American and other weapons to break this deadlock before it breaks Ukraine.
You're talking about the interviews that Zelensky gave to The Economist.
Yes. Yeah.
It's very interesting, and people should read them.
Well, I read the article too, and the least reported part was that he thought when the technical balance changes, then the stalemate that we see existing could be broken. So he's not defeatist, and you know, all the polling inside Ukrainian society, by the way, there's some 90% of Ukrainians don't want to give up land for peace. So manpower problem is as weak as serious as Stephen says, but are the Ukrainians convinced that they can continue to fight? They are. And they tell me when I travel over there, we know a lot more of us going to die, but we're not going to condemn our children and grandchildren to live under Moscow rule. And I think probably the morale is not so good on the Russian side.
But one guy reported to duty in Germany. He was an Ukrainian being trained by, who was 72 years old. They're mainly middle-aged men right now fighting, and women. Now they're starting to bring more men. Some of them are dying, but they're bringing in women as well. The number of young people running across the border is a lot, so much so that the Ukraine is using rather draconian measures to try and catch them and bring them back and put them in the army. It's a desperate situation. It's desperate. And we didn't talk about it, but I want to raise it. Zhelezhny, who is the general who is in charge of all the armed forces, he's the senior commander of Ukrainian forces. Zhelezhny is in a kind of battle with Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, over tactics. The split is something like this in rough terms. Zhelezhny wants to pull back what forces they have and consolidate them, create a real defensive line further into the interior of Ukraine, and not try to hold these areas in along the periphery where they're getting crushed. Zelensky has a different view, and his view is they have to win in Bakhmut, and they have to win in Avdiivka, they have to win in Krasny, Liman, they have to win in Krasnodarsk, they have to win in Zaporizhzhia, they have to win in Kherson, and so on. And the problem with Zelensky's view is it's very, very costly. No matter how you look at it, they don't have the manpower to support all those locations and to keep taking the losses they're taking. They just don't. And they're in kind of desperate straits. So that's the fight. So now there's a purge going on. And and people that are close to Zelensky, including the head of the medical corps, were thrown out this last week because they're putting pressure on Zelensky to support what the president wants. And by the way, Zelensky's military aide, top aide, he's a major, was killed. And some people think that it was, they're claiming it was an accident, but others think it was an assassination. So it's kind of nasty there, to say the least. And the thing could crumble any day. If we say we don't know much about inside Russia, and I completely agree with that, we don't know much about inside Ukraine either. There's a real struggle internally that's going on between the army as currently, and it also includes the commander of the ground forces, Sirsky. Then there's a big struggle between them and between the political side, which is represented by Zelensky, who's not a military man, has no military background.
Wouldn't it seem that Zelensky's disagreement over the tactics to be used are animated, first of all, by political concerns, not military ones, in the sense that to continue to obtain the military and other economic resources that Ukraine needs, he has to show progress, he has to show dash, he has to keep the attention of especially the American people, where there are signs, not certainly not a majority, but some minority that are questioning the continued multi-billion dollar support. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. You're absolutely right.
Herman,
it's also a question of not giving Putin bragging rights that he's finally won something, which he hasn't done during the counteroffensive. I would want to go back to one thing about deserters. When I was in Poland, when I was in Moldova recently, everybody tells me that 90% of the Ukrainian refugees are women and children. You contrast that with the big flight of men of draft age from Russia. You have, since the war started, over 1 million Russians have left Russia. Some of these are people with a foreign language and computer skills, but many are just trying to get out from the war. So it's, are there draft dodgers? There have been draft dodgers in every war that's ever been fought. Are the ones, the number in Ukraine high? No, I think they're low by historic terms.
There are a lot of desertions, and there are more and more Ukrainian soldiers surrendering to the Russians, so much so that the Russians actually created a radio channel.
What's your source on that? I've not seen that.
I will have to go look for it again, but yeah, it's been reported.
Herman, you had very extensive experience on Capitol Hill, working as a senior Senate aide. When you hear what's being said now about continued military and financial support for Ukraine, are you confident that that will be forthcoming, or is there some erosion of the support for it?
There is erosion of support, but I think aid will pass the House by at least 2-1 and by a bigger margin in the Senate. There are procedural problems and problems within the Republican caucus, but I would place a big bet that the aid is passed.
Steve, do you have a thought?
No, I think that's right. I agree with that. I think aid will pass. It may get delayed, but it'll pass. Yeah. But I don't think that's the main problem. The main problem is what I'm trying to tell you is that what happens on the ground is going to define the outcome here, not whether you send more aid or something like that. And the other thing is the timeliness, and I can hardly say it, the timeliness of supplies. The Ukrainians say they're short, and they are short, because what they'd like to be firing off, they don't have. And that's going to get worse, because we're not going to catch up to a production level that will really, well, let's take 155. I just wrote an article about 155. This is the artillery round. It's kind of a big one. That is one of the big, the most important parts of the war for the Ukrainian side. The Russians have their own called the 152. It's almost the same thing, 3 millimeters difference. Right now, the Russians are out producing us about 2-1, not counting what they're getting from North Korea. So I'm not sure how good that stuff is from North Korea either. But in any case, they're outproducing us by a lot. And we're ramping up. We're trying to ramp up. But even our plan to ramp up will fall far short of what is being used in this war by the Ukrainians. Not only that, but now the Israelis asked for 300,000 rounds or some number like that, which we've had to ship in because of the war in Gaza and in with Hezbollah in the north. And so those had to go there, which we hadn't planned on. And if something happens in Asia, in Korea, for example, then we're in really big trouble. So you know, I don't think we can supply what the Ukrainians need. And then when you get to precision weapons, anti-tank weapons, anti-aircraft man pads, things like that, those take years to build. Unfortunately, we had a very small stockpile. It's mainly empty. So those take years to replace. There's just no fast way to do it. So we're in, not in the strongest position to be helpful to Ukraine, even with all the money in the world. I mean, you can put more. There's so much money going into Ukraine that right now, I read in the Russian press today, and I think it's accurate, that the Ukrainians have been buying U.S. treasuries with a lot of the money they've been getting. They have about $28 billion in U.S. treasuries at the moment because they can't spend it all.
You have a U.S. source for that?
No, it's a Russian source.
Yeah, but sounds like it.
No, but I think it's accurate because it's based on data, which you can get. And I'm not going to dispute it. But even, you know, the fact of the matter is this is true because Janet Yellen, among others, has said it outright. We are supporting the Ukrainian government 100%. They can't operate without U.S. money, period. They're paying their wages. They're paying retirements. They're paying operational costs with the money they're getting from the United States, period. So that's not good news for the future. But your theme was, what about the future? I mean, suppose the war ended tomorrow morning. How's Ukraine going to survive?
I think there's going to be a massive amount of European money, private and public, to rebuild Ukraine.
Rebuilding money is one thing, but they need a daily operating money. Where are they going to get it?
I think it's going to come from confiscated Russian assets in part. To my take in talking to people in European governments, is they're committed to have Ukraine succeed when the war ends, whenever that may be. We'll see if they keep their word. They don't always, as you know.
I wish I was as optimistic as you are about that. I mean, a lot of people say, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But Europe is going to also facing, Germans already have a recession. They have a lot of their own problems, and the winter's coming. They're going to want to fork more cash over to Ukraine. I'm not sure about it. We will, but I'm not sure the Europeans will. And can you think you could sustain that on the Hill? It's going to be tough, very tough.
We'll find out. So we're getting into a lot of what ifs.
Well, it's not just what ifs. It's a question of you have to have a plan. And I don't think the administration has no plan. I mean, let's be honest, they have no plan at all.
Well, I agree the administration hasn't set out to the goals they need to, but there have been many meetings of governments in Western Europe and the U.S. about money that would come from international financial institutions, money that would come from private sector to work on Ukraine. And Ukraine has been working on day after programs for some time. So its planning is quite far along in Ukraine in terms of reconstitution of their society.
In the short range, gentlemen, what do you think is going to happen this winter? The winters there are fairly brutal. Will they just hold the lines where they are? Will their side attempt an offensive in those conditions?
Well, the Russian, it's already started to turn, the weather. There's sleet and snow in some places already on the battlefield, and a good deal of mud. You get a little of each. I think the Russians may well launch a large offensive, maybe as early as February, March.
That's when the ground freezes. Right now, as Steve said, on the Eastern Front, it's getting quite muddy. And if you haven't been in Ukraine mud, you can't understand.
It's pretty bad. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, I was once in a car driving from, before Russia took over Crimea, driving from Crimea to Kiev, and it was during the spring season. And the car, to avoid an agricultural machine went off the road and immediately sunk to the axle. We went out to push and we were up to our
yeah, hips.
Never seen anything like it.
Yeah, well, it's the Black Earth. You know, it's called the Black Earth region for a reason.
Yeah.
It's a great agricultural area.
But the weather is not so harsh in other parts of Ukraine. You know, Bob, you're from Chicago, and Kiev weather is something like Chicago weather. And if you're down by Kherson, it's you know, it's much milder.
So. Yeah, I think what's going to happen, what I read from various sources, is that the Russians are amassing a large missile capability and may well go after the energy, what's left of the energy infrastructure, as part of their warfighting operation, which will make it very difficult, or more difficult in Ukraine than it currently is. But that's, you know, there's no guarantee of that. That's just what people are saying.
It's harder to fully knock out than people think because so much is underground.
Yeah, but the power plants aren't. And they can be destroyed. I'm not, as I say, I'm very pessimistic about the situation on the ground. And I think that it would be nice if we got honest evaluations from our military leadership and NATO about just how difficult the situation really is. We're not getting that. We're getting, I think, a story that's not truthful.
Well, as I said, you have some military people like Breedlove and Hodges and Clark, our stars, that think our military is too pessimistic. So I'm not a military expert, so you've worked in the Pentagon, so I should bow to you on that. But I think it's fair to say that there is division of opinion among professional military analysts.
Well, we do have some hints. Because, you know, it's difficult when you're supporting an ally or a friend to get, say, current operational military leaders to say anything negative. You know, not going to say anything negative. And I can understand that. But, we, you know, there was a leak of some Pentagon documents that were pretty revealing a few months ago that gave us a picture that was not a picture that we've been told. And that's an internal Pentagon evaluation assessment. And it showed the 7-to-1, they were claiming 7-to-1 losses, 7 times more Ukrainians than Russians of men and equipment. So it was pretty dismal.
And I don't think that's remotely credible, 7-to-1 Ukrainian to Russian. Ukraine's been on defense most of the time, and the Russians have been using human waves that have been shut back by cluster bombs and so forth. I think
I don't know where you come up.
Now, I've never heard that the Russian losses.
It says right in the Pentagon document. It's not something the Russians say.
In any institution, I don't know any credible source that thinks.
Well, that's a credible source. I don't know how you can get more credible than that. I mean, unless you don't want to believe them. I don't always believe everything the Pentagon says, mind you. I'm sure you don't either, but that's what they said, and it wasn't a public, you know, for public dissemination. It was leaked.
How credible are the casualty figures for both sides?
You know, it's very hard to say with any certainty because both sides lie about it. And they lie intensively. Mm-hmm. So some people have tried to overfly cemeteries and count graves. But that's really only possible in Ukraine. You're not going to overfly them in Russia because they're not going to let you. So we have that, and then they're having terrible problems just to keeping, you know, finding places to bury people in Ukraine. But I think the real thing to watch, as you mentioned it before, is the operational readiness of the brigades that the Ukrainians have. That gives you some better idea of their capabilities, or what's left of their capabilities. And remember that we armed organized 12 Ukrainian brigades, 3 of which were completely westernized, and the others were mixed as part of the planned offensive in the south, which failed. And, you know, those were fairly full at the time. Now the problem is they're trying to use some of these National Guard units and reserve units to fill gaps because they're getting too bloodied. And everything I read, and again, we're always dealing with assessments, which are hard to make, but basically they're running out of manpower. And they wouldn't be so desperate about recruiting people if they weren't running out of manpower. They just raised the age to 60 for recruits, and they include women now in combat roles. So I think they're in a tough condition. That's my assessment. I don't have any reason to change it.
Hearing the analysis of Russia the same way. They have lots of brigades that are not fully manned. They're taking people off the streets. They're just pulling them. They're using prisoners and sent them to the front lines as cannon fodder.
Well, the prisoners were used for Wagner.
On their side, too.
The prisoners were used for the Wagner group. I don't know if they're still doing it.
They're still being used.
Yeah. Could be. I mean, it's a great way to save money.
Yeah. Gentlemen, what about the dangers of escalation? That was a very big topic when this war began almost 2 years ago. There would be a discussion of sending certain kinds of American weapons, the Abrams tank, et cetera. And then the response from the Russians or from Putin himself would be that crosses a red line. But several of those red lines have been crossed. And the thing people fear most, which is the use of nuclear weapons, has not taken place.
Right.
I think the latest iteration is that we may be sending longer range HIMARS to Ukraine. Steve, you can correct me.
We don't have very many.
That's another problem. And again, the Russian response is, you know, that's a red line.
Well, I think the question about the long-range HIMARS is whether they'll be used against the Russian territory rather than in the war.
In Russian territory.
That could cause some real difficulty with the Russians.
Ukraine has struck Russian territory.
Yeah, numerous times.
And
there's a big difference between a UAV with a grenade tied to it and a HIMARS with a great big warhead, and especially because it's accurate. So you could hit the Russian headquarters or a Russian airfield. I mean, it's a fairly lethal weapon. In fact, it's vital to us for our Pacific defense, which is worrisome because as we deplete those stocks, we're not going to be able to replace them for some time.
Herman, you mentioned Putin's nuclear blackmail in your opening remarks.
Yeah.
What's your assessment? Is there still a threat of escalation, or it's less than it was, or it still may be coming?
Well, I don't believe nuclear weapons will be used. The people that are in the chain of command, and it's not purely Putin's decision, are quite sober human beings. I've met some of them over the years. I think China is clearly against it, because if the nuclear threshold is broken, how long before Japan and South Korea and Taiwan go nuclear? So I think we've been under pressure, as we understand it, from China. But can you say there's no risk? No, but the risk of not confronting nuclear blackmail is bigger than the risk of standing up to it.
I think that's about right. There was, you know, some screaming by Russian TV personalities, let's call them that. We should nuke them. Yeah, but we got guys like that here too. So Putin's a sensible guy from that point of view. He's not going to use nuclear weapons. I don't think, first of all, I wouldn't even know how you would use them. How would you use them?
What would be the target?
Yeah, I mean, unless you wanted to obliterate Kiev or something, but beyond that, the problem with nuclear weapons today is they're too big. Put it simply. I mean, the Hiroshima bomb is a peanut compared to the stuff that we have today, or the Russians have, or the Chinese have, which are megatons, hundreds of megatons. The Hiroshima bomb was either 8 or 11 kilotons, and it took out a whole city. So, you know, these things are not usable unless you want to commit global suicide, in my opinion. I'd wish we could get rid of all of them. But that's a wish. It's not going to happen, but it's a wish.
You've already remarked upon what Ukraine's and Zelensky's position would be in any negotiation. Give everything back, and then we'll negotiate.
I didn't say that.
What about an anticipated Russian opening view in any such negotiations? What would they demand or require?
Well, you didn't mention the fact that they want NATO out of Ukraine, 100% out of Ukraine, and to some extent, Ukraine demilitarized. That's part of the Russian argument. That's not likely to happen, but that's what they argue. They're going to want some recognition of these areas which are now incorporated into Russian territory. That would be, I would imagine, would be Donetsk, Luhansk, Crimea, maybe parts of Zaporizhzhia. So they'll demand that. So the argument's going to be around that. And on what basis could Ukraine make such concessions, if Ukraine will make any concessions? We don't know. Zelensky does not wish to make, as Herman quite rightly points out, the Ukrainians do not wish to make any concessions, whatever. They want the Russians out of Ukraine 100%, and then they want the Russian leaders and the military guys and all the rest tried for war crimes. That's their position. Now, that's not a position for a negotiation. Can't happen unless Russia was defeated.
Yeah.
And even then, I'm not sure they would negotiate.
Yeah. Why would they? You said earlier, I want to agree with, he said it's going to be determined, the settlement will be determined by what happens in the battlefield. And as we see that play out over some months, at some point, we'll have a sense of how this thing is going to end. But I think the military dynamic has to play out first before we can have clear lines of what's possible.
I agree with you, provided that I think we, from our point of view, American point of view, the worst case would be the collapse of the Ukrainian regime, okay? And the Russians just take over the whole place. That would be the worst case, seems to me. We're playing a game where we're watching the battlefield. If you watch it accurately, in my opinion, I know you don't share it, but in my opinion, the Ukrainians are getting rolled up slowly but surely. Now, when does that lead to a break in the government, and how long do you have? I would say the maximum you have is a year. Maximum you have is a year, and it might be far less. And the Ukrainian government could fracture. So that's the game, I think. You're right. It's going to be the battlefield, but it's also going to be the political part that goes with the battlefield. And then you'll see where we are. I mean, there may not be any Ukrainian government to negotiate with.
Or if you want to be
on the, you can't write that off. You know,
if you want to be on the optimistic side, you have fatigue of Russian troops. The Ukrainians get another 20 miles south around Takhmak and can cut off supply to Crimea. And then
I tried that once, didn't work. It's not going to work. I wish it would, but it won't.
We'll find out.
We're going to find out a lot of things, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Steve, do you foresee a scenario in which Putin would accept what you just laid out? You get Donetsk, Luhansk, and you get a NATO-free Ukraine? Is that enough for
accept
him?
It? Of course he would.
Victory?
I think he'd accept less.
Yeah, I agree.
No, but I mean, I think it's a question of there's no negotiation, so there's no conversation. Look, they had a negotiation in 2022 that almost reached a deal. And I think a former Israeli prime minister was involved in that. The Turks were involved in it. And it's a very interesting thing. And they almost reached a deal, and apparently Washington said no, and that was the end of it. It would be neat to know what that deal was. My guess is, and we don't know for sure, but my guess is it looked a lot like the deal that was agreed in 2015 in Minsk. That's my guess. And the Russians would have settled for it then. Now, with a lot of water over the dam since then. But what the Russians will take now, I don't know. I mean, Putin's a very wily politician. He's got to stand for election again, too. And the Russians will have elections. The Ukrainians won't.
Yeah. Come on, Steve. there's no real election in Russia, and Ukraine has had.
Well, no, I don't think there's
Ukraine's
a real election in either. Look, let's be honest. In Ukraine, all the opposition is suppressed or in jail or in exile.
Oh, that's nonsense. That's complete nonsense.
Not nonsense.
I've been going to Ukraine for a lot of years. You've had hundreds of mayors and city councilmen and that have lost elections and stood down.
Oh, in the past,
even
yes.
Even at the head of the country. Lost election.
Zelensky says in martial law, there will be no elections. Put it there. You disagree with that? That's what he said. I didn't say it.
But you're talking about Ukraine being a democracy. This is a time of war where you're heavily occupied.
I hear you. There won't be elections in Ukraine for the foreseeable future, neither for the parliament nor for the presidency.
Okay, I'll accept that, but that's different than saying there will be elections in Russia, which are.
There will be elections in Russia. You don't have to be honest elections. Why would they have honest elections? They never had it before.
Completely cooked, and Ukraine is 30.
Yeah, but you're not listening to me, Herman. Of course they're cooked. That's how it's like. How do you win 97% of the vote? Tell me how you do that. You don't do that in this country.
Yeah.
Right.
Gentlemen, it seems to me, no matter the outcome, what is guaranteed is enmity between Ukraine and Russia for generations. Do you think I'm overstating that? It seems unavoidable at this point.
Been for generations anyway.
You know, but more and more intense now, especially after
I agree.
The war crimes, after Bucha, and what's happening to the kids. Nobody living will forgive the Russians. And by the way, it's not, I'm speaking of Russian citizens, not ethnic Russians. The second largest city in Ukraine is Kharkiv. It's ethnic Russian and Russian speaking. Third largest, Odessa, Russian speaking. The city that was laid to ruin, Mariupol, ethnic Russian and Russian speaking, and they're all with Ukraine and against Moscow. It's about freedom of religion, freedom of political freedoms, economic freedoms. That's why they're fighting.
Okay. I'm not going to get into that debate because why did they bar the teaching of Russian culture and history in the Ukrainian schools? Why had they decided that Russian language is not a second language in Ukraine and can't be used for any official correspondence, whatever, where it always was? Why have they gone after the Russian Orthodox Church? All this stuff about this great freedom of religion in Ukraine has some real limitations, it seems to me. I'm not a specialist on Ukraine, so I'm not going to, I've been there, but I'm not going to make any claims. But I think it's not a one-sided argument about the Russian-speaking population. That's what the Russians say they're fighting for. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but that's what they say.
When I travel in Kiev, I hear Russian in the street. I can get Russian language books, and nobody thinks a thing of it.
Okay.
You know, when you were discussing,
if you're Catholic in Ukraine, if you're a Baptist, if you're a Muslim, you don't have problems. You have problems if you're in the hierarchy of the Russian Orthodox Church, because they've always been associated with Moscow intelligence going back to Tsarist days and still aren't.
Well, they put the patriarch under house arrest, right? In Kiev.
And why?
I don't know why did they do it? They claimed that he was pro-Russian. He was pro-Russian. Why do you put him under? If they have so much freedom there, why did they put him under house arrest? Why did they raid the premises of the Russian Orthodox Church? I mean, they can't do it, have it both ways. It's either one or the other.
You mentioned that the enmity between Ukrainians and Russia goes back. Of course it does.
1,000 years.
Well, Solzhenitsyn made the interesting remark from his experiences in the Gulag Archipelago and his association with fellow Ukrainian prisoners, that he came to an appreciation of how deep this enmity was. And he saw that there would be no settlement of these issues between Ukraine and Russia without that border area adopting a kind of Swiss canton arrangement, that you have local autonomy within these groups, and there that there would be multiple cantons. Having lived in Switzerland for a few years, I know it works. It's a I don't know to what extent that in fact
is what the Minsk agreement was about.
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly what you're saying, is exactly what the Minsk agreement foresaw. And not only that, as I said before, it gave the I can't pronounce it correctly, so I'll just call it the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada, that gave the Rada, they were to come up with the legislation of what would constitute autonomy, and they refused. So, because they didn't want anything to do with it. But that was part of the deal that was that failed. And the idea of autonomous areas would be a decent settlement, particularly if both sides, the Russians and NATO, got out of there.
Let me close with this question. Zelensky recently remarked that since the outbreak of the Israeli-Hamas war, that deliveries have appreciably slowed down. Well, of course, he's talking about ordnance, but there is a bigger problem, that the attention span of Americans is notoriously short. And what's been on the front page is the Israeli-Hamas conflict. And, you know, Ukraine isn't in A10. It's still a major issue. But do you see any danger of the Ukraine-Russian conflict being crowded out because of what's taking place in Israel and the Gaza Strip, or potentially other conflicts that could erupt from North Korea or Iran?
Well, it certainly impacts the bandwidth of decision makers. There's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, if you're sitting in the Pentagon and you're getting, you know, 10,000 messages from Israel and 10,000 messages from Ukraine and 10,000 messages from Korea and so on, it's hard to deal with. I mean, you're just dealing with all this paper and all these problems. And then there's no doubt that our resources are limited.
You know? I agree with Steve. It sucks oxygen out of the air. I do know that when Hamas leadership went into Moscow, they said, "We have no better friend than Russia." And it's not difficult to imagine why Russia would try to stoke that and problems in the Balkans and other places as a way of further sucking oxygen out of there. It's a problem.
Their policy on Hamas and on Hezbollah, to add to the equation, is awful from my point of view. Absolutely awful. But, you know, they're turning the screw. I mean, let's face it, that's what they're doing. And we have to figure ways to turn it back, but we have to be real careful here, because I don't think there's any military solution for Ukraine right now. I think it's the reverse. That's my concern. And I wish I was convinced otherwise, but I'm not.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're out of time, and I would like to thank our speakers, Herman Pershner, the president of the American Foreign Policy Council, and Steve Bryan from the Center for Security Policy, to join us today to discuss the future of Ukraine. I invite members of our audience to go to the Westminster Institute webpage to see our other offerings, quite a number on the subject we've addressed today, as well as China, Japan, Taiwan, and even a program on what the real causes of inflation are. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Robert Riley.